Welcome back to Memorial Day weekend, and we've got an exciting speaker for you. This is worth coming back from the holidays here. Sally Brown is a research assistant professor in the College of Forest Resources. She also directs the Soils Lab, the ecosystem sciences development in the...
Well, actually, I don't do that anymore.
You have to.
Anyway. See, it's okay if I introduce myself. It's really fine. You can relax, get a cup of coffee. It's okay.
She received her bachelor's degree from Williams and her master's degree and PhD in soil sciences from the University of Maryland. And she's twice been awarded the U.S. EPA Clean Water Act Research Award for her work with biosolids, and she also received the King County Green Globe Award. Yeah, I want to brag about you because you can brag about yourself. She's also a member of the National Academy of Sciences Standing Committee on Soil Sciences, which is really a prestigious committee to be on. Let's offer an enthusiastic welcome to Sally Brown.
I very much appreciate your being able to walk up the steps on Tuesday after the holiday at 8:30 in the morning. And I know that it was not easy for me to decide that today was really a work day, so I appreciate your efforts in this regard. I want to talk to you. This is a topic that I do a lot of work on, that my prejudices are pretty clear, so you'll be able to tell those pretty quickly. For me, as there's all this talk about, if you or anybody pay any attention to fashion at all, obviously you can tell that I don't. But, gray is this year's black, well, green is has been this year's black for a couple of years. And for me, if you look at wastewater treatment and understand the potential in wastewater treatment for how green we can be for something that you never think about, or if you do, you usually think about it as kind of like, this is really a path to being truly green, not just this year's bold color of the month. Anyway, so that's what I want to talk about. Now, let's see. Okay. Probably you don't pay a lot of attention if the water doesn't back up when you take a shower about where the water goes. Am I correct? As long as it goes away, it's fine. And that's been when you flush the toilet, if it goes away, everybody is very, very happy. Right? And if it doesn't, that's when you start getting a little concerned about this. But the fact is that where the water goes is something that is a very well-developed infrastructure in this country. It's a very well-developed infrastructure in Canada and Europe, and you start going other places and you don't have that infrastructure, and you start understanding the importance of wastewater treatment. And in fact, how wastewater treatment, treating dirty water and providing clean water, is a very, very key thing to public health. And the way things are done in this country, does anybody know this already? You can interrupt me or talk if you have any desire to. And it's 8:30 in the morning on Tuesday, so I understand if you don't. Anyway, the way water gets to, did anybody know where this is or what this is? Okay, so I'm sorry. And you know which one it is? West Point at Discovery Park. So when you shower, when you flush, this is where it goes, assuming you live near you, okay, and not in Renton. If you live in Renton, you go someplace else when you flush. Anyway, these are wastewater treatment facilities in this country are publicly owned. So when you get a water bill, you're paying for the operation of this facility. These are municipal employees that take care of this. And water comes in here from a range of sources, from your house as well as industries and offices. And in some cities, they have combined systems for when it rains, so combined storm water systems. In some cases, they have separate systems for storm water. Okay. When the water comes in here, before it leaves, before it gets discharged, it has to meet state and federal standards. There are permits for discharging that specify turbidity, biological oxygen demand, fertilizer content like nitrogen content, pathogen content. And the solids that are produced in wastewater treatment also have a rigorous set of standards that have to be met, both national, and they can also be local standards as well. So where did this whole wastewater treatment thing come from? There were wastewater treatment plants starting at the turn of the century in some cities, making water go away in a lot of cases. You first had the understanding that dirty water was responsible for cholera. Anybody know when that happened? Some people. In England in the 1860s or 70s. So you're starting to see wastewater treatment in larger municipalities, but the big push for wastewater treatment came, and a lot of funding for wastewater treatment came in the 70s in the U.S. with the Clean Water Act. And this was a piece of environmental legislation that had a big dollar tag associated with it. There was a lot of funding available to train civil engineers to operate these facilities and also to build and upgrade these facilities. So the West Point treatment plant used to only do primary treatment, letting stuff sink, and then whatever didn't sink got discharged into Puget Sound. In the late 60s, I believe, maybe it was early 70s, before the Clean Water Act, they upgraded to secondary treatment. So that helped purify the water coming out even more. So the Clean Water Act was the big environmental legislation that, anybody know the goals of the Clean Water Act? These are great goals. Making all waters in the U.S. fishable, swimmable, and drinkable. And if that were the case, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? And realize it's much better than it used to be. You also realize that the impetus for the Clean Water Act came because we let things get as terrible as they did. This is the Cuyahoga River outside of Cleveland. And anybody know what happened to this river? It caught on fire. Do rivers normally have, is this what you think of a river, burning river? Not normally. So things were pretty bad. And there were a couple of incidences. The river catching on fire was a big one that spurred on the Clean Water Act. Okay. In addition to these very high-profile river on fire things, there were other insults that weren't as dramatic that when you were little at this time, and not many of you in this room were little at this time, but you used to think this stuff was just the way it was, and you didn't think it could be any different. Anybody know what this is? Where this is?
Gasworks.
This is, no, it's not gasworks. You're still not supposed to swim in gasworks, but we do, actually. I live right on next to gasworks on a barge, and in the summer when it's hot, I jump off the, anyway. This is Lake Washington, and it used to be you couldn't swim in Lake Washington. So if it was a day like it was last week when it was wonderful and 85, you could forget about sticking your feet in that river because it was too dirty and you weren't allowed. Okay, so wastewater treatment and all the money that's been put into wastewater treatment has had phenomenal results in terms of public health. Diseases that are the primary killer of kids on an international level. Realize that gastrointestinal diseases are the primary killer of kids. Diarrhea, waterborne diseases, Giardia, dysentery, cholera. We don't have those anymore. If you go to other countries, anybody been to China? Anybody drank out of the tap in China? You would never drink out of the tap in China. We've taken things to extremes. I feel very comfortable now when my dog comes to campus, even though she's not allowed to, and Bob Edmonds isn't going to tell him here. But Sadie loves to drink out of the toilet bowl here. And the toilet bowl here, we use potable water for the toilet bowls, which is a little extreme. I always say that maybe the dog will get smart if she drinks university toilet water, but it hasn't seemed to have any effect. Anyway, what we've gotten here with wastewater treatment is a very, very high level of cleanliness in our potable waters. So people don't get sick. It's a very, very rare case when anybody gets sick from drinking tap water, which is unusual for most of the world, okay? And in addition to that, the natural water bodies, like Lake Washington, you can swim in. And in fact, the Charles River, for example, there was a song about that dirty river. Nobody's old. It sucks to be so old. Let me tell you. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It said that dirty river, the dirty river Charles. It's okay. Anyway, it was a big. Basically, it was a hit song. It's a pop song about how filthy the Charles River was. And at this point, they've started having outdoor swim events in the Charles River. So we've made a lot of progress. And so what I want to talk to you today, basically, is primarily one of the products of wastewater treatment and how we can make even more progress by utilizing the products from wastewater treatment. So basically, when you realize that the water goes away, don't just not think about it. You should be a little proud of this and realize how sophisticated our infrastructure is. And then after this talk, hopefully you'll realize what the potential is to take advantage, to take further advantage of these systems. Now, come on. Come on. It's working. It's thinking. Okay. Now, we have two choices here. I can do this without slides, or...
Probably can get yours out.
Yeah, let me get mine. Okay. So when you make a wastewater treatment plant, you make two things. You make clean water, and you also make solids. Now, first I'll talk...
Sort of seems to work.
Oh, it's better now. I'll leave this as a backup. Okay. See, it's good. I forgot I was going to talk about this. So where does the water come from? The most visible source of input into a wastewater treatment plant and stuff that people get very paranoid about, and they should because you're supposed to, everybody knows after you go to the bathroom you need to, yes, wash your hands. So toilets are one source in the house. That's your black water. Other sources include showers, your kitchen waste, office building waste, and industrial inputs. What's the one of the biggest industrial inputs into our system? Boeing. Okay. When you are an industrial facility and you want to have access to the wastewater treatment system, you have to apply for a discharge permit. What you discharge into that system is regulated. You have to let the treatment plant or the wastewater treatment division know what contaminants you're expecting to discharge, what your expected concentration of contaminants is. You have to realize that wastewater treatment is a biological process. If you put poison down there, you'll kill the bacteria. Okay. So there's in every city they have source control, which is like pre-treatment police. They're the contaminant police. And so they'll know if anybody is dumping anything of any significant quantity above their permit. So, for example, in Seattle, there were instances where they were detecting higher than normal chromium concentrations in the water. They knew that there was one source of chromium. So they called this particular industry and said, we think you may have a problem because we're seeing higher chromium. The industry said, oh no, we're fine. So they have a whole set of pipes and infrastructure for discharge, and they took samples and narrowed down the source of chromium. And then this one particular industry in the Northwest was not happy at all when the news hit the press that a prominent Northwest aircraft manufacturer was illegally dumping excess chromium. And they got fined, they got a lot of publicity. So these are your sources. In the King County area, the vast majority, I don't remember, 80 or 85% of the water that goes into the wastewater treatment system comes from domestic sources or office buildings. We don't have heavy industries, okay? In some cases, like Tacoma, heavy industries have been food processing industries. So realize there's a wide range. Okay, this is what I'm going to talk about. Biosolids are the solid stuff. These are dead microbes. These are the microbes that in the wastewater treatment plant eat and eat away, thinking that all that chemical and biological oxygen demand coming into the treatment plant is like Thanksgiving every day. And so these materials have a fertilizer value. They have nitrogen and phosphorus. They're about here. They're about 6 to 7% nitrogen, 3% phosphorus. They have a carbon value. Carbon can be used as a way to improve soil carbon. It can also be used as a source of energy. Is reduced carbon. Okay, so you have two values here. You have the nutrient value and the carbon value in the biosolids. And then you get reclaimed water. And what you're starting to see in this county is a recognition that reclaimed water has value. Right now, all our water gets discharged into Puget Sound. And there's a big program now at the South Treatment Plant in Renton to use this water. So there's a golf course coming online. The cities of Auburn, Renton, Tukwila are all growing fast enough that they're going to be running out of water. They're not going to have enough water for the growing population. So they're desperate to get reclaimed water from the county South Treatment Plant so that they can continue to grow in population and not run out of water. Other places realize that this is a big issue. In Southern California, in Orange County, they're so short of water, they're talking about taking this reclaimed water and treating it so that you can drink it, so it becomes potable water. If you live on the Mississippi, further down on the Mississippi, you have to realize that you're pretty much drinking reclaimed water if that Mississippi is the source of your water, because you've had any number of municipalities discharging into the Mississippi. Okay. So you're starting to see, and there's a new treatment plant for King County coming online. They just started construction north of the city. That's going to be a different kind of treatment system, very clean water. So pretty soon, the flowers that you buy from different greenhouses will have been grown in reclaimed, using reclaimed water. Okay, this has nutrient value, blah, 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 you read it.
Okay. So I'm not going to talk so much about that. This is Dana. She's a grad student of mine. She's working on the fate of estrogens in reclaimed water, irrigated turf. Where did the estrogens come from?
Wastewater.
Yeah, wastewater. But why are there estrogens in wastewater?
Birth control. Everybody happy that birth control pills exist? I would think that yes. Okay. Okay, so what do we do here with our biosolids? Well, King County uses the vast majority of the biosolids to fertilize crops. These crops range from Doug Fir, commercial tree plantations, the Snoqualmie Tree Farm and Washington DNR land, to wheat in eastern Washington, hops. So if you drink beer, anybody drink beer? Hops, biggest hops producing region in the world is outside of Yakima. There's a lot of biosolids used to fertilize hops and compost and other agronomic crops. These are biosolids that are treated to Class B standards, which means they kill 99% of the pathogens, but there are still some pathogens, so you don't use them to grow strawberries. Okay, because you can eat strawberries, and it's not a good thing. But beer, it's okay, because the hops grow out of the soil, and the fruiting part is well above the soil, no contact. Now, this is great that we use this for fertilizer, especially realizing that in the last year, the cost of fertilizer production has gone up 300%, and that to make synthetic fertilizer is incredibly energy intensive. And in fact, if you calculate how much energy it takes to make and apply and transport fertilizer, if you use biosolids instead, it's equivalent on a per hectare basis to about 1.4 metric tons of CO2 saved. Okay? That's not a bad thing. It's also much cheaper for the farmer. So if you're a farmer growing a crop like dryland wheat, which the economics are kind of iffy, using biosolids can help you stay in business. Okay? Now, you also have to take into account transport. And so King County drives their biosolids about 400 miles round trip to get to the wheat fields. Now they're using biodiesel in their vehicles, so this is actually lower. But even with that kind of haul distance, and everybody knows driving trucks is very bad for greenhouse gases, you still get a net credit in terms of greenhouse gases for using an organic or organic carbon source of fertilizer. Now,
What else do you get? There's a study that's coming out of Virginia Tech, and they looked at carbon accumulation in no-till. We're starting to get into why this is nice stuff. You probably figured the flow on that, even though it's early. It's pretty obvious. Nobody's laughing. I'd say maybe you can laugh. Anyway, study out of Virginia Tech, and they looked at carbon accumulation in no-till ag. Realized that soil carbon can be a huge storage bank for sequestered carbon. So not only do you sequester a lot of carbon, high carbon in soils makes your plants grow better. So if you switch to no-till, you can register a project on the Chicago Climate Exchange and you get about 0.3 tons of CO2 per hectare as a credit. This study looked at a range of farms in the Virginia area, see how fast carbon was accumulating. They also looked at farms with biosolids and did that make any difference in the carbon accumulation. So you go 0.3 tons of CO2 per hectare. This is not going to make you rich in a year or two. But in the farms that use biosolids, that 0.3 was up by 4 tons per acre. There wasn't specific information in this study about how many biosolids applications, rate of applications, but they were able to draw the conclusion that you could get 4 extra tons of carbon per hectare with use of biosolids. So not only are you getting carbon credits for energy displacement for not using synthetic fertilizers, you're increasing soil carbon. How much does that mean? How much carbon is in a hectare? Anybody know what a hectare is? I bet the teacher does. A hectare is 100 by 100 meters. So it's about a little over double an acre. You guys know an acre, right? But I bet you don't know, it's 43,560 square feet. The reason I know that was because they asked me that on my PhD defense exam, and I looked at them like, I wasn't expecting that. So now I will always know that. Anyway, if you have a soil and you increase it, the carbon concentration 1%, so instead of a 4% carbon, you have 5% carbon, is that a lot? Anybody ever shoveled soil or garden and know that soil is relatively heavy? Top 15 centimeters of soil, if you have 4% carbon, that's 80 tons of carbon per hectare, that's 220 tons of CO2 per hectare. That's the equivalent to 17,000 plus gallons of diesel fuel. You notice how I switched from metric to US system? That's not professional, you should not do that, I just realized it. Anyway, but if you multiply that by say 4 to get liters, it's even better. So realize though that when you're talking about increasing soil carbon through use of residuals like manures and biosolids on a per hectare basis, you can store a lot of carbon in a soil system. That's a 4%. If you add 1%, you still are adding a very substantial amount of carbon. And with biosolids as one of the tools, you can do it with a range of other tools, composts, manures, you get a really big boost. So this is one of the good things. Now, what is King County doing? And this is also happening in Portland and other parts of Oregon. Anybody know what this is? Oh, and there's going to be another picture if I click like this. Look at that. It's actually canola. This is canola. And you know what canola makes, everybody? It makes canola oil, which is one of your primary oil feedstocks for biodiesel. So in fact, the biosolids from King County, a portion of them, and a portion of the biosolids from Portland are being used to grow gas, to grow diesel fuel. Okay. So this was work that we did in Sunnyside, Washington. These were the initial field plots. And what was nice about this is we expressed our results from this trial in gallons per acre. How many gallons of fuel per acre? When we first started talking about this, the farmer as well as the biosolids program in King County looked like, you guys are very nice, but you are really nuts. And now your buses contain this fuel, which is pretty neat. So what happens in King County, every time you flush, and you can think about this and be a little proud of this, and especially more of this happens in Portland. So if you have any desire to move to Portland, you can be very proud of showering in Portland.
You really should laugh at some of these things. Okay. As a wastewater treatment, we make this yucky stuff, this yucky brown sticky stuff. If you land apply it, you can grow canola and make your own fuel. This is biodiesel, glycerin on the bottom and biodiesel on the top, and you can use it to power your trucks, among other things. And what hasn't been done yet, but they're doing it in other places, like San Francisco, this bottom stuff, glycerin, is really nice for making soap. Anybody use Pear soap or the Neutrogena glycerin soap? But it's also a very rapidly degradable organic compound. And you put it in an anaerobic digester, which is how they stabilize the biosolids in the treatment plants, and you get a lot of methane. And methane is used for energy. So you can use this whole thing to make energy. And the meal that's left, you use to feed the cows in Yakima County. So instead of importing meal from Canada, what's happening now is we're using the biosolids to grow the canola and feeding the cows the meal locally and making biodiesel. So Ted Durfee,
the farmer that started doing this, has gone full scale. He's best buddies with Ron Sims now, and the governor comes to visit him. So this is not so bad. He called me up, and you're missing one picture here. But he called me up. He said, "Sally, you ever hear Pimp My Ride?" They came and filmed part of an episode on his farm. So how often do you get from flushing the toilet to MTV? It's a pretty neat connection. And here he is, the governor. He's gotten an award from the governor. She's mentioned him in a number of state of the state and other addresses that she's made. But this is a very nice model of sustainability. And, okay. So this is one way, one sequence of ways you can use biosolids on agricultural land. Another way that I've done a lot of stuff on is for restoration sites. And I've done this within the EPA Superfund program. And I don't know Aaron Brockovich personally, but I have seen the movie. This is another bad joke. We've got a little more. Okay, this is one of the sites where we work, Leadville, Colorado. And it's pretty obvious what they used to do in Leadville. Leadville is also at 10,000 feet, so when we did the research there, anybody ever trying to breathe at 10,000 feet, it is a challenge. It is a real challenge. And if you have a glass of wine at 10,000 feet, you don't need that second glass. Okay. What happened in Leadville? When they were mining for the lead, this was done in the 1910s and 20s. There was no EPA, so they were not regulated on what to do with the tailings. These were very high mineral deposits, very high in pyrite, which when exposed to oxygen makes sulfuric acid. Okay. So they had big piles, and in this part of Colorado, it either doesn't rain or it rains a lot. You know, it's not a nice steady drizzle like we have here. So in flood events, a lot of these tailings got deposited or flooded into the river, and they came out as tailings deposits all along the Arkansas River. Nothing would grow in these, and in fact, I have a picture of a letter on my computer from one of the farmers in the area from Colorado State from 1914 saying that the irrigation water they were using from the Arkansas was basically toxic mine waste. And so this whole area, this stream here, which had been great for trout, and the whole ecosystem around this was dead. We used biosolids from Denver, along with lime from a range of sources, and treated all the tailings deposits along the Arkansas River. And amazingly enough, once it started raining, these got really green. And in fact, if you look, let's see. Come on. You can see the top is the before, and this is the after. You can tell the difference, right? It looks better here. It had looked like that for 80 years. Okay, come on. Come on. Okay. Looked pretty, but was it safe? So a toxicologist from EPA did a whole range of tox studies on this. We fed earthworms in the poor earthworms in the control soil, the tailings. They wouldn't go into the soil. They said, "I'm not doing this." And the poor thing stayed on the top and died. When you treat the tailings with the biosolids, you get survival that's very close to
to the uncontaminated soil from a nearby area, but you also get very fat worms. So not only are they living, they're eating and they're getting fat. We looked at body burdens of cadmium. We looked at microbial activity in soils. We looked at plant uptake. We looked at small mammal trapping and body burden in small mammals. We looked at a whole range of things. Even if you put the tailings back into the river, will the fish live? And this is a result from the Fed Head Minnow study. The fish are happy as anything. So we've now gotten this, so it's an approved remedial technology within the Superfund program. And this has been used at the Bunker Hill site. It's being used at the Jasper County Tri-City Lead site in Missouri. This is a pretty neat thing to be able to use residuals from a city to restore areas that there were no cost-effective ways to fix things with. And from a greenhouse gas perspective, which is what I've been doing a lot on lately, you also go from a system that has very low carbon reserves to a system that has a functional soil with a whole lot of carbon in it. So the soil here, the soil carbon, this is a control plot from a small-scale study, 213 tons of carbon per hectare. 7 years after the biosolids were applied, we're up to 800 tons of carbon per hectare. So you take that soil carbon from a farm system and make it like steroid charged. But you don't get penalized because it's not like a major league sporting event or the Olympics, so they don't do doping trials. These are so stupid. You shouldn't like the teams.
Anyway, and I have a student now who's working on trying to come up with a way to quantify increases for soil carbon on restoration sites where you use residuals so that you can get credits on the Chicago Climate Exchange or other carbon exchanges for this, which would be a nice impetus to use this approach. Realize when you use this approach, you get the carbon, you've gotten documented ecosystem function. So that means you go from a place like this, this is a swamp in Idaho, the Bunker Hill site, you had no microbial activity, you had no leaching cycle, no plants, nothing. Nothing is going on here. To a functional system where you get organic matter coming in, where you have fish and birds and river otters and habitat and plant diversity, all these things, instead of starting with a pristine system and making sure you protect it, you have the potential here take thousands of acres in this state alone and across the country, coal mines, gravel pits, hard rock mines, all these types of sites, and bring them back to functional systems that look beautiful using stuff that started out in your toilet. This is a pretty good idea. Now I have to take a sip of water. Okay, yeah.
You had mentioned body burden.
In the Leadville site, they just did full body analysis. Mm-hmm. In the Jasper County site, these were leaded and cadmium and zinc contaminated sites, so zinc is a required nutrient, and the animals generally pass out excess zinc in their system. So you have to be concerned with lead and cadmium accumulation, which will primarily accumulate in liver and kidneys. So in the Jasper County site, they capped small mammals and did liver and kidney pathology. And in one out of the 100 animals tested, they saw some sign of abnormal function in the kidney and all the other animals they were calling. So there was no kind of any negative consequences. Yeah. If anybody wants to ask me anything, do you want to come out? I'm asking what? Tell me about it.
I'm not sure if it's the same big question you just asked, if quite good to say. But in the past, they wouldn't allow me to use biosolids. There was a lot of forestry costs, or basically the concerns of bioaccumulation of heavy metals.
I can tell you so much about that. Yeah, there was, before you had pretreatment regs, the EPA regs on metals and biosolids were developed in the late, it's a process of development. And it was science-based regs, and these have been looked at by a couple of National Academy panels. What the big deal is, though, and EPA has gotten a lot of criticism from the science-based numbers, because they were based on safety of the material using a highly exposed individualism model. And this was somebody that grew 60% of their garden vegetables on soil that consisted of biosolids for a 40 to 60 year period. Okay, so this was their risk model. And based on one of the deals here with using these biosolids on high metal sites to reclaim them is that we knew from these risk assessment studies that metals and biosolids were not as available as metals in contaminated soils. So the biosolids were doing something to bind the metals. So metals in the biosolids were not as available to plants or animals, and I'll talk more about this in a little while. What also happened, which has had a much more dramatic effect, is that at the same time these regs were being developed, pre-treatment regulations went into effect. And that's why you have places like Source Control of King County getting on Boeing's ass, I didn't say it like that, to watch levels of chromium. So what's happened is with these regs, these pre-treatment regs, the EPA regulatory level for cadmium is either 21 ppm or 39 ppm, I don't remember which. But with pretreatment, you've had municipalities across the country crack down on industrial dischargers so that cadmium and Chicago biosolids, which was a scientist's dream when I was in grad school, because I had old historic field plots where the cadmium had been 200 ppm. Now with pretreatment in Chicago, and you can't thank Barack Obama for this, even though some of us might like to, they're down, that was another bad joke, down to 4 ppm. So levels of metals and biosolids across the country, including King County, are well below regulatory limits and are not in any, that's not what restricts land application. At this point, what restricts land application is when you treat them to significantly reduce pathogens, but not completely reduce pathogens. So King County biosolids are treated to class B for pathogen reductions. That's why you're not allowed to use them on edible crops. Tacoma, which makes class A materials, you can, the regs were designed and the risk assessment was designed so that you could sit down and eat a plate of biosolids. So why you would do this, I don't know. And so, and what I'm about to talk about is actually Tacoma biosolids treated to class A that are used widely in the community. So now I'm going to answer your question at all? Okay. So I talked about agricultural uses, reclamation uses. How do these materials, or do these materials have a place in cities? And if they're treated to class A, there are no pathogens, so they're safe to eat. But more importantly, since you have to be nuts to want to eat that, they're safe to grow things in. And Tacoma makes a range of class A soil products. And Tagro in Tacoma is a very widely normal accepted thing to be used. And in fact, benefits, you have all the same benefits, but in addition to the benefits that you saw in ag land, you have the potential to reduce degraded urban soils and strengthen community gardening and growing things in the urban environment. What I've done in the past is had make soil workshops. And so I get biosolids from Tacoma because it's class A and the other ingredients that they use to make soil. And I've done this for master gardeners and for people at King County and for EPA regional officials and for my son's fifth grade class. This is Sydney Ladd from his fifth grade class. And now she goes to Hamilton and is a sophisticated seventh grader. But so you break a big pot of biosolids and you tell the kid what it is and they say, ew! And then I stick my hand in it and they say, ew! Can I stick my hand in? And it's really funny to watch the progression. Tagro has gone pretty far with marketing their materials. You can get Tagro tattoos. I don't know if you can see these on Sid's hands. You can get Tagro frisbees. A student of mine that works at Tagro has her Carhartt Tagro jacket. Pretty high status material. But realize that if you make the investment and take the initiative to start studies or start entering the, what TAGO has done is they enter Puyallup Fair and work with master gardeners as a way to market their materials, you have an enormous potential in an urban environment. These are pretty healthy plants. These are at the treatment plant where they distribute a portion of the TAGO. They have a big demonstration garden. They donate a lot of food from the demonstration garden to community food banks. And what Kristen, a student, has started to do is try and integrate use of the TAGO soil project products into community gardens as a way to kickstart growth of community gardens. This is a big deal in Seattle. Not in every community do you have the same well-educated gardening group that wants their PPAPs, that waits on a line for 3 years. So in Tacoma, she's gotten a range of community gardens, had loads of TAGO delivered, and what happens when you get the TAGO in the community gardens is the yields increase. So you have all these people that have never grown a tomato, and if they try it in the lousy, high compacted urban soils, low in fertility, low in organic matter urban soils, that tomato withers and dies the first week it doesn't rain. With TAGO, you get enough improvement in soil properties, and guys at WSU are looking at this, as well as Kristen looking at this, you get big tomatoes, and so these people are much more inclined to come back and garden some more. So if you garden and it succeeds, you're more likely to do it again. Same as if you take a calculus test and get 100, you're much more willing to register for differential equations rather than if you take a calculus test and you get a D. Am I correct? Yeah. Okay. So here's Kristen, and what's really nice here is she's worked with a whole wide range of community gardens, from yuppies starting community garden plots to Vietnamese community that garden and sell these plants to low-income housing project gardens. And she just got asked to work with people at WSU who are using gardening in elementary schools as part of the curriculum. And they just had 20 loads of TAGRO delivered to elementary schools. So. Now, another thing I want to talk about, and this has been in the paper a little lately, I don't know if it's been so much here, but nationally, there was an AP story about this, and I wanted to end with this conflict. In my line of work, you come across some interesting graffiti, and, I mean, usually you don't see this as graffiti, right? The kid's stupid because of the lead and soils. This is, again, from the Culver Hill site, but realize that aside from Superfund sites, you get high lead in soils in urban areas where there used to be cars with leaded gasoline and houses with lead paint. And the lead doesn't go anywhere. It stays in the soil, and lead is a big problem if you eat soil. And as a little kid, did you ever play in the soil? Somebody must have played in the soil. And did you get dirt on your hands, and did you necessarily wash your hands before you ate candy? No, you were a kid. So kids eat soil, and if there's lead in the soil, urban lead poisoning can be a big issue. Now, in one case, in Baltimore, where a lot of homes have very, very high lead, there was a program, and this was done by Johns Hopkins and Kennedy Krieger, a nonprofit institute associated with Johns Hopkins, and they used high iron compost from the wastewater treatment plant in Baltimore as a way to reduce lead availability. So what we've done on Superfund sites, they were doing it on urban gardens. And a Superfund site, if you have high lead in the soil, you dig it up, haul it away, and put it in a confined disposal facility. If you have high lead in a backyard, be it Oakland or in Tacoma or in Seattle, you claim it. Okay, so they put compost down. And what happened? They got a huge response in growth from the grass, which is pretty neat. So it's very, very hard for the kids in this yard to get to the soil to eat. Even if they want to, so they may have to try and pretend they're cows and eat the grass instead. But even if they did get to the soil, what they saw in the Baltimore study, using both total lead and extractable lead, they saw a very significant decrease in the amount of lead that was available. Here's a really nice way to take an urban soil contamination problem and fix it. We've done this. We've done a lot of work on this, looking at different types of biosolids compost. There was one from Philadelphia was the best. much better than the ones we tried to make adding iron chloride and iron grit. We saw lead extractability. This is from a soil outside of Wenatchee. Anybody know if there's a lead problem in Wenatchee? You know why that happened? There is a lead and arsenic, big problem outside of Wenatchee, a lot of Eastern Washington fertilizer. And the herbicides, actually. They used to spray lead arsenics on fruit trees. So any place where you have old orchard soils, you're going to have very high lead and arsenic. This is not a reason not to buy your dream house outside of Wenatchee. It's just something to think about. Okay.
Anyway, so using high iron compost worked great to reduce lead availability. They had very high concentrations in this compost of amorphous or very gelatinous high surface area iron. And what we did, and this was one of the best nerd experiences I've ever had, went to a synchrotron facility, which is a particle accelerator, and this is one out of Argonne, where they have particles traveling about the speed of light. So it's taking this light in this room and magnifying it about a million times, and you can use this very high intensity source of light to take pictures of things and to analyze speciation of things on an amazing scale. And so we use this to figure out where the lead was in the sample and what the lead was associated with. So these are pictures of lead and iron in the sample of control soil. And then here's more lead and iron in the soil we treated with the Philadelphia compost. And we figured out that what actually happens is when you put this high iron compost from your wastewater treatment plant onto this lead contaminated soil, the lead goes from these various forms, which have nothing to do with iron, and in particular the sericite is very available if you were to eat the soil, and you change them to all forms associated with the iron, which isn't available. So as we get a better understanding of the mechanisms of what's going on, we have the opportunity to take better advantage of this resource, whether it's through no-till ag and growing bioenergy crops or community gardens in urban areas. And so for me, using biosolids, even though it stinks and is kind of disgusting looking, is a real key to sustainability. And I said when I came in that I had a lot of pictures in the presentation, even a bad picture of me in a bathing suit, which is why, you know, I don't model for J. Crew and do this instead. This is the stupidest I've shown you. Here I am. So we can do all these wonderful things because this wastewater treatment plant, not only can we do all these wonderful things, but you can swim in Lake Washington. And except for the milfoil, which I think is pretty disgusting, but it's certainly not toxic, not even think about it. Depending on where you are in the country. There's a lot of public concern about biosolids, and in fact, I spent time on the lead because there was just an AP story about using this compost on these low-income families, and it was likened to the Tuskegee experiments where they let black people with syphilis continue to have syphilis. And then it was pointed out by Kennedy Krieger and Johns Hopkins, hey, wait a second, this stuff gets used not only on the White House lawn, but it's sold at Home Depot. This is regulated Class A material, and I got interviewed last week, the week before last, by another AP reporter to try and fix what AP had done the first time around. So depending on where you are in the country, in a lot of parts of the country, biosolids are landfill. And so for me, this is resource-based.